Gary Trenda works in live sound. He is an RF applications engineer at Sound Devices. After graduating from UW-Stout with a degree in manufacturing engineering, Gary performed at the Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas as their first audio RF technician. Gary got his start in broadcasting working at a Packers game at Lambeau Field when he met SBE frequency coordinators. Now, Gary is the frequency coordinator for SBE Chapter 24 in Madison. Gary's favorite gadget is his trusty Tektronix spectrum analyzer. He's also really into cylindrical lithium ion batteries like the ones used in Sound Devices products. Ask him later. Gary has over 20 years of experience in the program making and special events, PMSE industry. I've never heard of PMSE, but Gary is going to get us all saying PMSE after his talk. Gary has worked as an audio and RF engineer on installations and special projects, including the Latin Billboard Awards and Super Bowl 58. When he's not working, Gary enjoys taking his pontoon boat out on Lake Wisconsin with his wife, Maggie, and his daughter, Evelyn. Gary loves to travel. Tomorrow he's going to Amsterdam for IBC. So thank you for being here today, Gary.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Vicki. Good to be here. Yeah, so I'm Gary. I work for Sound Devices, which is a manufacturer of wireless microphones. But before coming to Sound Devices, I worked lots of different special events. And as Vicki said, we're trying to get people to think about this term PMSE for programming and special events. There's kind of all these disparate industries that use kind of the same common core of wireless microphone, IFB or in-ear monitor, maybe wireless intercom system. Think about like live events like concerts and touring, theatrical productions, as Vicki mentioned, you know, Cirque du Soleil, sort of themed entertainment things, but also, as you guys are well aware, broadcast events use a lot of wireless microphone, IFB, sports increasingly, like more and more is using all these different wireless systems. So we're trying to kind of make this umbrella term of PMSE more popular for people. So you think about it, it's not just my particular area of using wireless devices for events, but there's a kind of a huge industry built around these different systems. And as more and more people use these systems, and also as our spectrum becomes more and more crowded, areas where we've traditionally used these systems, coordination, especially at large special events, can be a bit of a challenge. And so I spend a lot of my time talking to users about setup and operation of their wireless systems, and I do a lot of coordination for these special events. Here in Madison, I coordinate all the University of Wisconsin football games. And so, as you guys can imagine, we've got quite a few different wireless users that'll come into a football game. And we'll talk a little bit about kind of frequency coordination for a special event like that a little bit later. So let's kind of get started with the slide deck a bit. But first, just give me an idea for all of you. I'm gonna try to make this a little bit interactive today. How many of you either use wireless microphones, IFB, intercom, or support people that do use those sorts of systems? Okay, so maybe half the folks here that are involved in that. In general, do you find that pretty easy to find spectrum where you're sending people to, or do you have trouble finding open spectrum for where your wireless mics are going? Yeah, it's getting tighter and tighter out there. All right. So let's talk a little bit about that. So here's me. We talked a little bit about like why should you listen to me about any of this stuff. I've just been doing it for a long time and I've made a lot of mistakes, so hopefully I can tell you the things that I've done wrong and keep you from doing those same things wrong that I've done. Some people know me from working the Super Bowl halftime show. I've done the last eight Super Bowls. I've done a lot of like award show type things, like here it mentions Latin Grammys, CMTs, and then as we talked about, you know, different frequency coordination for special events and things. But I got started kind of on the concert side of things. I used to set up PA systems for live events, and then I saw more and more at these live events, they're bringing in more wireless microphone systems and in-ear monitor systems. And as you're starting to deploy more of those at your special events, it becomes something that you can't just task someone on the crew with doing. I mean, in the live event world, someone who's either mixing monitors or mixing front of house for a band tends to be your RF tech, and they've learned a lot about how to set up a PA system, but they may not have a lot of education on how to set up wireless microphones or near monitors. And for broadcasters, the same thing. Like, just because you're a TV reporter doesn't mean you've got a lot of RF education, right? So again, a lot of what I end up doing is trying to set people up for success, give them the basics of what do I need to know to deploy a wireless system at whatever event site I'm going to. If you're not familiar with sound devices, a little bit about sound devices. Sound devices sort of started in TV film, sort of location sound world, building portable mixers, recorders, kind of smaller battery-powered devices that are used, you know, still very popular in TV and film. Pretty much any audio capture that happens on a TV and film set, there's really only two or three manufacturers that make that type of equipment, and sound devices is sort of the leader in that equipment. And then in recent years, sound devices have gotten more into wireless microphones. So if you've got equipment from a manufacturer like Electrosonics or Shure or Sennheiser, sound devices has kind of a similar product to that. And so, again, for me, I'm an applications engineer, so I get involved in kind of trying to make those systems work and also helping people use our systems with those other systems from other manufacturers, because there's such a wide variety of IFB and your monitor and intercom systems out there that get used with the wireless microphones. So just a kind of quick overview of what are we going to talk about in the next 30 to 45 minutes. Kind of pre-production, what's your local RF environment going to be like? What do you need to know before you go to your event site? Brief overview of the common spectrum that's used for these systems. What are your core bands? What things are out there, like, for example, T-band radio that a lot of your users might not be thinking about? What are some basics of band playing that you want to do for where do I want to put my microphones versus IFB or intercom, those sorts of things? We're going to talk a bit about Part 74 licensing. I deal with a lot of users who aren't aware that you can get a license to be a low-power auxiliary station user for the systems that they're deploying. And then changes that are happening. You may have heard of WMAS, Wireless Multi-Channel Audio Systems. There's been a rule change by the FCC this year allowing a wider bandwidth for the carriers that these wireless microphones and similar systems are going to put out. And so I think you're going to see a change in some of the available equipment, hopefully an improvement in spectral efficiency, but also some changes to workflow that, you know, if you're supporting people that use these systems, you're going to want to know about. As we said, some basic frequency coordination things, and then I'd like to leave some time for Q&A because I really want to tailor this to what you all need to know for the systems that you're using. But if we got time at the end, we can talk a little bit about college football and other sporting event coordination. I've got some examples of that. So we start with pre-production. If you're going to send somebody out to an event, this could be, you know, you're sending a reporter to one of the political conventions this year, you're sending somebody out to cover a football game, whatever it might be. Who's involved with the event? You're seeing more and more just various people coming in. There's going to be a broadcaster or multiple broadcaster. There's going to be whatever venue you're in, they're going to have wireless systems in-house. And so what RF equipment do I have available to send there, and how does this fit in with the overall RF equipment that's going to be on site? Hopefully, on a larger event, there's going to be some sort of event frequency coordinator that you can reach out to and start to have that discussion about, like, here's the equipment that I want to send. How does this fit in with everything else that's happening for the event? And then how much time do I have to set up? I mean, no, it used to be the events that I would go to, I would have maybe the luxury of going out ahead of time and doing a site survey to start to plan out what I want to do for my various wireless systems. And then I might have a setup day on site. Now more and more I talk to people that say, yeah, I'm going to show up at, you know, first thing in the morning and I expect to be on the air in a couple hours. And so the speed of deployment has changed workflows, I think, for people. But as I mentioned, who do you talk to for these different events? Is there some sort of production or local tech staff, different people that you can reach out to? Because really, I would say as a frequency coordinator, a good part of my work for special events is just getting in contact with all the right people and understanding who I can talk to coordinate frequencies with. Because a lot of times, the coordination information comes with just credentials that you have for the event, and that may go to you know, manager, producer, somebody up, and doesn't necessarily flow down through to the technical staff who really understand what's needed to coordinate these systems. And if you're the person who is, you know, maybe there's no local coordinator and you're just the person that's trying to figure this out yourself. How can I set myself up for success? What are some things I can do? The first thing, obviously, is being aware of the local RF environment. I think, in general, the systems that I see being deployed are, you know, using the core UHF TV band. So that's going to be 470 to 608 megahertz or something in there. But different cities have different broadcast TV, as you're all well aware. So where do I go to look that up? I mean, the Rabbit Ears website is a place that you may be familiar with. If not, it's a great resource to tell you what local TV is available. And then if you're getting into more of the concert and live event space, some of these other things like Shure's Scan Library, Gotham Audio Scan Library, and others are people that have actually been at specific venues for special events and done a scan with a spectrum analyzer, and then they'll post that online. And that can be helpful to know, beyond just what are my local broadcast TV stations, what specifically do those signal levels look like in the venue that I'm going to be in. And so if those are available to you, it's a good place to go to kind of start your research. And then, do you want to actually do a frequency coordination? And this is kind of an open question depending on how complicated your deployment is, but if you've got a mix of vendors and systems between microphones and in-ear monitors and intercom systems, it's typical to use some type of software to do at least a simple intermod study so that you can best coordinate the frequencies that are in use. We can talk a little bit more about intermod later if you want to. Some people are very familiar with it. Other people don't understand why you'd need to do that with your various mics and in-ear monitor systems. But also spectrum analyzer, again, some people are very familiar with. How do I get a visual look at what's in the air in my local RF environment? I know a lot of manufacturers, including sound devices, are starting to put spectrum analysis functions into the wireless receivers for these microphone systems. And so that can be helpful if you have that tool available to you without having to carry extra gear that may be complex to set up or operate. And then, you know, what other informational databases are there out there to document what you're going to be doing for your event? All right, so everybody loves this great spectrum chart of there's a lot of spectrum available in the US, except there really isn't, because most of this is full with other services and systems. So we talked a bit about what are the core TV bands, and I'm sure many of you have lived through a couple of TV repacks at this point. I mean, I'm old enough to have started with wireless microphones that could operate from 470 to 806 meg, which just today seems like in crazy talk, right? But it is true that we've gotten rid of most of 700 meg first, and then we sold off most of 600 meg. And so now that we're operating in, you know, less than a quarter of the spectrum that we used to, what do we do? Well, we start to band plan, and we start to look for unused parts of spectrum that might before have seemed like an unnecessary place to operate, but now more and more we're seeing systems that operate there. Here's an example of some common spectrum that is legal to operate wireless microphones and other devices in. So VHF TV is still a viable option for various systems. Sometimes just the size of the antennas for this make it a little less popular for portable systems, but I still see intercom and IFB and VHF, and that can be helpful when you're in a real crunch for available spectrum. Again, we said 470 to 608 is kind of our core band. Where I see a lot of people starting to deploy, especially lower channel counts, because they just don't want to have to worry about broadcast TV, is this duplex gap, the 653 to 663 area is becoming more popular. Also STL band. So there's some different rules for various parts of it, but generally speaking, 941.5 to 960 is an area where you can deploy these wireless systems. And then AVTRAC as well, just because of the amount of spectrum there. I mean, AVTRAC is more restrictive as far as the rules that you have to follow to operate there, but it's 90 meg of spectrum. And so I think for some large special events, that's gonna be more and more utilized for the systems we're talking about today. And of course, deckband intercom, for a lot of the wireless intercom systems that used to operate in UHF or VHF, we're seeing a shift up to decked band or even one of the ISM bands like 2.4 gig or 5 gig. So if you're not familiar with kind of the state of UHF television, this is a graphic that I like that shows like what happened with this, the sell-off for cellular band 71, which is what occupies most of 600 megahertz now. This is where services like T-Mobile, 4 and 5G, cellular data, Dish Network owns some of the spectrum, but That got chunked up into those uplink and downlink blocks A through G that you can see. And so duplex gap, when we're talking about 653 to 663, that's what we're talking about, is the gap between the uplink and downlink for cellular band 71. And then you can see what is left for UHF TV from 470 to 608. And you can also see there's a small guard band above TV 37. There's a couple of megahertz there that you can use for unlicensed systems. Another thing I end up talking to users about quite a bit is T-band radio. So T-band radio is basically two-way radio. A lot of times it's used for various public safety systems. It can be used for other systems by special authorization, but it's the low part of your UHF TV band. And so in these specific cities listed, you're going to have some amount of 470 to 512 meg that's in use by two-way radio. And I think the thing that becomes challenging with these systems is if you're used to just going into a venue and doing a scan to see what's available for open spectrum, you may not see these systems, but then what has happened to me a number of times is as your various police, fire, EMS people come into the venue, as the event, you're getting closer to the start of your event, and they start using these frequencies, you get this very strong interfering signal that's intermittent. And so for people that aren't aware of these systems existing, it can be kind of disconcerting. Like, wait a minute, this worked fine 3 hours ago, and now I'm having all sorts of problems. And so while it is, I believe, technically possible to coordinate in some of this range, if you're not deploying a really large number of wireless system channels, I tend to just avoid these specific channels in these different geographical areas because it just saves you from a lot of headache later. So we talked about where these systems allowed to operate in, and then here's an example of how would you band plan it if you've got some mix of IFB, IEM, microphone, and intercom. One thing that I can tell you just from my experience coordinating events is having your IFB or IEM transmits separate from your mics is kind of one of the basic things that some users are not aware of the need for. Because for the RF nerds in the room, you know the front end filter on your microphone is going to exclude frequencies that's outside of your tuning range, right, or your tuning bandwidth. And so if you're putting a strong IFB or IEM signal inside your tuning range of your microphone receiver, you're kind of causing interference on yourself potentially, right? The sensitivity and selectivity is decreased because of those strong interfering signals. So sort of basic stuff you can do, separating your different systems out. Even when you're purchasing these systems, more and more we're seeing systems that are wideband, but previously you would be buying a system that maybe had 24 megahertz of tuning range. And so buying a microphone that is in a different range from your IFB is a really pretty good idea generally. And some other band planning considerations are, as we mentioned before, the need for coordination. And what do you have available for equipment? Do we have such a level of congestion that we need to timeshare? I mean, one example for the football games that I work at is you could have something that's just happening during pregame. Sometimes we've had, like a Fox show, Big Noon Kickoff is going to be in Madison this weekend, right? They're going to be done by the time the game starts. And so if somebody wants a microphone for a post-game interview, they could potentially be time-sharing with a Big Noon Kickoff frequency if we're very congested in a particular area of spectrum. Other things that you might think about is uncommon systems. RFID is becoming more and more common. I've done corporate events. I've worked in stadiums where they have RFID now at shops, where like these, kind of an Amazon store sort of thing, where you walk in and grab something off the shelf and just walk through a little reader, and then it charges you automatically for whatever you took. Those RFID systems are a lot of times in 900 ISM band, as our intercom systems can tend to be. So being aware of systems that operate in the same spectrum but are completely different uses can be helpful to you as well. So I know that's a lot of just what are we talking about with different frequency coordination setups. Can we do some Q&A now on that before we kind of go on to FCC rules? Do you guys have anything you want to talk a bit more about with that, particular challenges you've seen or questions about system deployments? I've covered this too well, or you're all asleep.
I guess one of the things I'm wondering is someone who hasn't spent a lot of time in a scenario like this where you've got an event going on and there's a lot of congested RF, how does an RF coordinator deal with the situation where you've got someone who's stepping outside of their bounds, they're running on a frequency that's supposed to be protected for somebody else?
Yeah.
How does that, how do they normally go about that?
Yeah. And that's where I said kind of half of my job is just talking to people and figuring out some of these problems. Like, if you approach somebody as the Department of No, which I think people have this impression of frequency coordinators being like, you're not allowed to use that frequency, shut it off right now, that doesn't work well. But generally speaking, I'll approach someone like, I'm the frequency coordinator for this event. My job is to give everybody a clean wireless frequency to operate on, right? So we're trying to find everybody their own lane to drive in, because if you try to put two cars going at each other in the same lane, they're going to crash. And most equipment out there right now is frequency agile to the point that we're able to find frequencies for people. It's rare that I have to tell somebody they have to shut their equipment off. It's very common for me to just ask them to tune to a different frequency. And the challenge there, again, is just sort of user comfort with their equipment. I mean, I see a lot of ENG crews that if I ask them to retune, they're like, I have no idea how to retune my wireless microphone, right? Which is just kind of the reality today. And so same thing, just try to be helpful there. Like, I've tuned a lot of wireless microphones for ENG crews, and they tend to be, you know, pretty cool about it. Like, they're like, oh, thanks. So I appreciate you helping me out and getting me on a frequency. I won't tell you who, but we had somebody at the last Badger football game that came in and knew about the frequency coordination requirement, decided they didn't need to do it, but then contacted me and said, well, my mic's not working, right? And so I asked them what frequency they were on, and they told me, and I'm like, well, that's, and they were from not the Madison area. I'm like, well, that's a local DTV transmission here in Madison, so you're probably experiencing some significant interference, right? I'd be happy to give you a frequency that's not on top of local DTV, and same thing, like they didn't know how to tune it, so then I help them tune it. So I think it's a lot of that. Like, I, you know, try to just tell people that, you know, my role at an event is to make everybody's stuff work and to make your day easy. And if that's true, then I think people are usually pretty receptive to it. Does that help answer your question? Yeah. Anything else?
What is a silent DJ?
Oh. Yeah, that made it to my slide because it gave me a bad day at one point. There are a lot of corporate events now. So if you're in a room like this, you'll go in and they'll give everybody a wireless headset to wear. And so sometimes it could be a DJ playing music and you see people dancing, you don't hear any music, and it looks kind of weird. But other times it could be just because you don't want the sound of the PA system, or you're in a room that's really challenging for a PA system. I mean, it's a little reverberant in here, but I've been in rooms that are just terrible for speech intelligibility. So those tend to be systems in 900 ISM band, in my experience, where it's one transmit frequency and then could be 100 sets of headphones that they're deploying. And so it's another one of those systems that those guys come in and just set them up and don't talk to the frequency coordinator, typically. And so I tend to wander around, and if I see a bunch of wireless headsets on a little rack in the entrance to a room, I start asking some questions, right? All right. Anything else before we start talking about the exciting FCC rules related to wireless microphones? Sure.
I'm just curious about hearing aid and those loop systems that have. Mm-hmm. How do you coordinate with those or the other headsets that they use for hard of hearing?
Yeah, so there's various types of ALS or assistive listening systems out there, right? 216 megahertz is common for like an FM assistive listening system, and so some events that I'm at, we'll have to coordinate those because that only allows you 216 to 217, so you can't fit a ton of channels in there. The inductive loop systems are really a magnetic pickup kind of thing, where you have some sort of a coil in your hearing aid, or maybe you wear a coil around your neck that you pick up for a pair of headphones. That tends to cause like more hum and buzz problems in audio systems because you're putting that audio out on a magnetic field than it does RF problems. But I've been involved with events where they have to turn off the loop system because somebody's guitar on stage was picking it up, because like a single coil guitar pickup does a great job of picking up a hearing loop, right? So, but yeah, it's a good point. All these ALS systems there's infrared ones, there's RF ones that operate in 216 generally, and then there's the inductive loop systems. All right. So FCC rules. Most wireless microphone systems are at least capable of being operated on an unlicensed basis. So that's part 15 of the FCC rules. But that's generally lower transmit power, and there are some bands that are not allowed by part 15. So for kind of anybody in this room, if you're already involved in broadcast, I would really encourage you to see if your organization has a part 74 license, and if you don't, get one, because it's not terribly difficult. It's not expensive. Anyone who's a broadcaster qualifies for one. And it gives you some amount of protection with other users, but basically just gives you some standing to say, look, I have a license as an auxiliary user here, and other than the main broadcast TV, I've got a right to operate these systems in these bands. So the slide lists out some of the what are unlicensed and what are licensed bands and sort of this common core spectrum. A big thing for me, for my events, if you're in a city that's got a lot of DTV, if you're indoors in an arena and a DTV station is relatively low power, you know, technically below negative 84 dBm on your analyzer, you're allowed to put wireless mics there because they're saying the signal indoors is so low that you don't really expect someone to be operating a TV antenna there, right? So that opens up a lot of spectrum for the events that I do. White space devices were a bigger deal some years ago. I think we may see that come back with some different technologies, but currently white space devices are not something that I see used a lot and or causing interference in for the events that I coordinate. And then, as we said, licensed operators are the secondary user to any licensed TV station, T-band system, or other primary operator, but they do have a higher standing than just someone with an unlicensed Part 15 system. I don't know if this is really pertinent for the folks here, other than to say that any broadcast network entity, cable television system operator, or the other folks that do productions are eligible for a Part 74 license. So I think that means pretty much anybody here is going to be eligible for a Part 74 license. And why do this? I mean, as we said, it can open up additional bandwidth to you, additional power levels to you. It gives you some standing. Also, I mean, one thing that I try and emphasize to people is it gives you some amount of visibility with the FCC. I mean, as particularly the telcos and mobile data providers are pushing for more and more and more spectrum, it's important that the FCC understand the amount of users that there are in these ranges. I mean, there events that I go to that have hundreds of wireless microphone systems and maybe three licenses among all of that is sort of crazy, right? So I think we need to be just more advocates for, these systems are necessary for producing the content that you're expecting to see on your streaming services and broadcast television and all the other various platforms. And then WMAS, so as I mentioned at the beginning, WMAS is something that as of February this year, there's a change in the FCC rules to allow it. Some of the boring technical details are that previously, a wireless microphone was allowed up to 200 kilohertz of bandwidth to operate and send that wireless audio signal. For an FM system, that's traditionally been fine. As we're getting into more digital systems, it kind of pushes the technology, so you have to really be efficient to send a high quality audio signal with some sort of a digital carrier in 200 kilohertz. And so the push was to allow for a wider carrier. And the rules at this point say that now we can go up to 6 megahertz or one full TV channel for a carrier. It has to be a multi-channel carrier. I think it's going to say here or on the next slide that what does multi-channel really mean? Multi-channel means that you can do at least three audio channels per megahertz. But I think what's really going to happen with this is you're going to see systems where you used to try and coordinate a dozen frequencies. Now someone's going to come in and say, I need one wide bandwidth carrier. And I think this is going to be good and bad for depending on your local RF environment. Because if you're in a large city that maybe only has two or three open TV stations, or I did an event in Phoenix, Arizona, where there are literally no open TV stations from 470 to 608. If somebody comes in and says, I need 6 megahertz there, what do you do, right? So depending on the amount of available spectrum, this is going to simplify things for users, I think. It's going to increase spectral efficiency, so that's a benefit, but it's also going to add some interesting complexity to frequency coordination, because we're sort of used to a channel being a single wireless mic or IFB, and that's going to change moving forward. And we're going to have to do, I think, a little bit more negotiation. And we've already seen this happening with intercom systems. We mentioned previously DECT band, the 1920 and 1930 megahertz, being used for intercom systems. Most of these intercom systems are multiplexing into a fairly wide channel. In DECT band, it's 5 2 megahertz wide channels, and they're doing up to 50 users for some of these systems. And so now if you get multiple users who all want to bring in DECT band intercom systems, it becomes more of a negotiation of like, well, we've got a max pool of 50 users. How do we allocate that to what's being used on site? So you're going to start talking about users and bandwidth, I think, more than just channelization and assigning a specific frequency to a specific microphone. So here's a really awesome graphic showing there's 200 kilohertz over there on the left, and that's what we've got now. And so this is what's going to change. Now you're going to see varying bandwidths. I know Sennheiser, as an example, has said that their system wants the whole 6 meg, that they're going to deploy a system with 6 meg worth of bandwidth for the WMAS system. Other manufacturers have said that they want it to be adjustable, maybe 2 or 4 meg or even less. So it just sort of retreads what we talked about. One interesting thing in the new rules is that no minimum bandwidth for WMAS is defined. So it really is just that 3 audio channels per megahertz. And so you can kind of dial the bandwidth up and down. Now, there's some technological challenges with that, but I think that's going to be fun to see what various manufacturers decide to do to address different concerns in that area. Power levels is one other thing that's kind of worth thinking about. Your overall power tends to go down, because if you're operating under the existing rules, let's say you had a Part 15 unlicensed system that's a max of 50 milliwatts, that's true kind of regardless of the bandwidth. And so 50 milliwatts spread across 6 meg is generally lower power, and you're going to see some interesting challenges and changes with the technology there. And then, as it mentions, now for licensed users, we are going to allow up to 100 milliwatts. So that, again, deciding how wide that carrier needs to be and what kind of power level you need to operate on is going to be an interesting thing moving forward. So Intermod with these new WMAS systems is going to be less of a concern. So you're going to see less focus, I think, on Intermod coordination. With older FM microphone systems, this was a pretty big deal for a lot of people. And so folks that have been doing frequency coordination for a long time, you hear them talking about, you know, needing to use software and do an Intermod study, and that's still a good best practice, I think. Do you all have any interest in talking with any detail about why we care about an Intermod study for our microphones, or is that kind of like, I understand Intermod, I don't need this? Yeah? All right. I can come back to it later if we got questions. So, in fact, this is a good break for Q&A. So going through all that exciting FCC regulatory stuff, do you guys have any questions about that? You all have your Part 74 licenses, you're all set, you know where all the frequencies, where everything's operating. We're all good to go. Right on. Okay, let's talk about college football. I like college football. So here's a sample of coordinations. I'm just kind of going to run you through a little bit about, like, for me, leading up to a game at Camp Randall Stadium here at for the University of Wisconsin, what are we doing? And for any event, like, I could be going somewhere else in the world to coordinate an event, and I'd want to know the same thing, like, where is the event? And I literally get down to, like, the latitude and longitude, because I'm probably going to be doing some searches of some FCC databases to see what licenses exist within a particular radius of that location, right? When is the event? In the case of college football, who's going to be the broadcaster? And who's the frequency coordinator? In this case, me. So what happens first? Well, we get a request for the in-house wireless systems, this is something that I'll tend to clear at the beginning of a season, right? Because your in-house systems aren't going to change a lot. So this has changed since I put this slide together sort of intentionally, but this is an example of what your in-house request might be. So you've got some wireless microphones, you've got some IFB systems, you've got, in this case, a decked band intercom system. So this is something you would, and for me, I'd enter into the frequency coordination software that I'm using, and I'd start assigning out frequencies to that, and again, I'd start with my band plan. So with this particular request, I'm probably going to start with the electrosonic system because it's got, you know, a less tuning capability than my field mics do. And so I tend to start with things that have a limited bandwidth, so I can put those where they have to go, and then the rest of the system's kind of filling around it. And then along with that, the TV truck's going to say, hey, we've got a bunch of gear we want to bring in. We've got talent with a microphone. We've got an IFB for our talent. I've got parab mics that I'm going to put around the field for these, you know, big dishes that we try to hear the, you know, quarterback or hear the pads knocking together and all this fun stuff for effects that you hear on TV. And then we're going to have an intercom system, and this intercom system got cut off, but this one does UHF and VHF, which is kind of unique to the various intercom systems out there. And then you might have your home radio that says, well, I want a sideline reporter with a microphone, and I want an IFB so I can talk to my sideline reporter. So kind of the point of thinking about all this is each one of these users individually thinks like, well, I need four frequencies, I need a dozen frequencies, like, this is super easy, right? But as you start to kind of aggregate all this together, and each one of these folks, you'll notice, they don't just want a primary frequency, but they want a backup frequency. And so, in some cases, if you're one primary, one backup for every one of these systems, that now doubles the size of your frequency coordination. So it's interesting to see at events where I might have 200 frequencies in a coordination and 120 of them are in use. And that is fine if you have a ton of spectrum. That's not fine if you're really tight on spectrum. And so it's helpful to think about that, I think, for you all as users. To my example before, if you, instead of saying, I'm using this frequency, approach the frequency coordinator as, I have this available equipment, it tunes in this range, what's going to be best for your event? That's super helpful. And also saying, like, are you on site at the event? Can I get a backup frequency from you if I experience interference? Like, what's the process for that? Because different events will have a different process for that. And so maybe there's, for larger users, you can have a pool of backup frequencies that be used across all your equipment rather than one mic and one backup for every single thing. And then on the game day, we'll then have some local media that will check in. And so sometimes you've got your starting point for your coordination, and then on-site, people are coming in and saying, oh, I've got, you know, I need an extra, what is this? This adds another dozen frequencies on game day of various systems for ENG crews, local crews. I'm surprised how much we see these sort of like reality TV-ish crews following around the coaches and players. You know, I see a lot of crews for us here. It's Big Ten Network typically. Well, they'll be coming in and they want to shoot sidelines and locker room and things during the game day. And those guys are, it's a very fast-paced workflow for them, and they generally tell me they don't have time to coordinate frequencies. And you say, well, look, we kind of have to, because you can't just drop another, you know, dozen channels of wireless in amongst 140 and think you're not going to step on somebody potentially, right? So I think I've kind of driven this home a lot, like communication and coordination is the kind of the name of the game for us. Okay, so this is another good break for, you know, questions about just coordination workflows. All right, how am I doing on time? We've got about 4 more minutes. Yeah, oh.
Gary, I've got a quick question for you. What system are you using to process the information that you receive from your users?
I still use IAS, which is a software from Professional Wireless Systems. I would probably not tell you to use IAS if you're starting today, but I used to work at Professional Wireless Systems, so it's kind of the I've done so many events with it, it's the system I know. Right now, there's a couple of popular frequency coordination packages. Shure, who's a wireless microphone manufacturer, they have something called Wireless Workbench, which is a free software that you can coordinate their systems and other people's systems with that software. So I definitely would start there because you can't beat free. But if you get to the point where you're doing more sophisticated coordinations, higher channel counts, it needs more sophisticated database functions, there's really two good software packages out there that I would recommend taking a look at. One is called EasyRF. It's like one guy up in Canada that makes this Windows software, but it's a pretty robust feature set. And then the other is there's a company called Showcode, and they've got something called Coord, which is an online tool. And so that's nice because there's a free online setup for Coord, and then you can then go into a paid system if you need more robust features for it. And so Coord is good. And then EasyRF would be the ones I'd look at. Other questions? All right. I've got some Super Bowl pictures if you guys want to see Super Bowl pictures.
One more here.
Oh.
Hey, if someone's stepping on your audio, is there anything you can capture in the moment to try to figure out who it is later?
Sorry, so for an interfering, if I see some interference, how do I figure out who it is? Yeah, that's a really good question. So I tend to have some sort of directional antenna for my trusty spectrum analyzer that we talked about at the beginning. If you see somebody on a spectrum analyzer, generally speaking, you can try to demod the audio if it's like an FM signal, or you'll know looking on the spectrum analyzer if it's a digital signal. And then you really go just try to track them down. Like I just walk around with my spectrum analyzer, my directional antenna, and start turning it and figure out stronger this way, stronger that way. And so you get a lot of weird looks wandering around a stadium, like waving around a directional antenna. But I can say when I started at University of Wisconsin and they had some seasons without frequency coordination, I spent two or three seasons of doing a lot of tracking people down. But then once people, you get the same people coming to these events sort of year after year, as you guys probably know. So once you get people the understanding that like, hey, if I just come in and turn on a wireless mic, this weird guy's gonna come find me with his antenna. They just start to email you before the game and ask for frequencies. And then when they're on their assigned frequencies, I don't track them down, right? So it's kind of it works out okay. All right, other questions? All right, so this is, I just used this example of the Super Bowl because this is kind of one of the more fun ones for me. We were in Minneapolis. We had Justin Timberlake, and he decided that he wanted to start the halftime show underneath the seats in like a club area, and then walk up into the stands, and then out of the stands, and out down on the field, and then kind of wander all around the entire football field, and then finish up in the stands on the opposite side of the field. So using a single microphone and a single in-ear monitor system for that's a pretty huge challenge for, you know, kind of the production mics and in-ear monitor systems. And so this gives you an example of the setup that we had. And then here are the different zones. So you see we set up really three different zones of diversity antenna receive and then transmit for his in-ear monitor system. And we ended up using a system from Shure that has four antenna inputs. So you could have, for example, like antennas E and F on that diagram on, but A and B as well. And so your receiver sees four different signals all at once. And so as you transition from one zone to the next, you're not as worried about dropouts. And then we ended up switching, when he was up and on the field, we would switch off the EF antennas and switch on over at CD. And the same thing, as you can see, 1, 2, 3 for our transmit locations. We would have 3 and 2 on, and then we'd turn, when he's up in the stadium, we turn 3 off and turn 1 on. And so having distributed antenna systems with then distributed transmitters was sort of a first for us with this sort of event. And it was just kind of a cool thing to engineer out. And then here's a fancy drawing of all the receivers and filters and everything that we did for that. And so that was a pretty fun Super Bowl for us. All right. I think that's 45 minutes. Thanks for all staying awake. Any last questions before we get out of here and have lunch?